I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. And today's a special thank you for listening to Voices in the Family. And that's why every week when someone asks me what the topic for the show is going to be, I explain a little bit about it. And almost everybody says, well, that's interesting. And they say it whether they mean it or not. But leading up to today's show, the reaction was very different. I tell them what the show is about, and I hear, or some variation on groans. Talking about parenting after the loss of a child can be one of those, quote, difficult conversations that can feel too hard to listen to, too painful to look at. And you know, I agree. And while right now, many of us might not be able to relate to a specific loss of a child, we may still wonder about the experience. We may still want to face our own vulnerability. And even if not, we may face a time, and many of us have experienced this, when we don't know how to be supportive of a friend or a family member. So if we're lucky, we can learn what to say and what to do. Most of all, we can learn about just listening and being there in the face of what feels like unfathomable pain. On today's show, Kathleen O'Hara is my guest. She's a psychotherapist who specializes in traumatic grief counseling. She's a survivor of a family homicide, and she joins us here in the studio. I should say, truth be told, she's become a dear friend of mine. Kathleen, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so pleased to be here and see you again, Dan, and it's just a great day.
Yeah, it sure is. Later on, we're going to be hearing from Jennifer Scalise. She's the author of A Mother's Journey of Love, Loss, and Life Beyond. A recreational accident claimed the life of her daughter, Brooke. And she'll join us by phone later on in the show. And we'd love to take your calls. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, Kathleen, your son Aaron was murdered Memorial Day. And, 1999, 13 years ago, he was abducted while away at college and murdered, and your life changed. But, you know, I was rereading your history, Kathleen, and it hit me, Memorial Day. Mm-hmm. What's this like for you? Do you have anniversary reactions? Have they changed over the years?
Every year, May is probably my least favorite month. It hasn't been 100% reclaimed, but it's certainly gotten better. It's gotten much better than obviously the first couple of years that I think were the worst. But even now, you know, Memorial Day, I have always said it's for the fallen soldiers in the war. But what about the war against crime, the war against trauma, all of that? I feel like Aaron was a victim of that. And I've had some peace through the years, but it is still a loss. And I think for every parent or any parent who loses a child, regardless of how they lose that child never really dies. The child can't die. The spirit goes on.
Yeah, years ago I interviewed some people in the wake of my sister's death. And now, she was in her 50s at the time. But I wanted to know the experience. A year later, I want to know different people's visions of where she is now, where their loved one is now. And I interviewed a Buddhist monk who lost his brother. And he said, when my brother was alive, he was alive for me in 50 different ways. He said, and now he's alive for me in 49 different mm-hmm. ways. And I thought that was just a beautiful way of putting it.
That's so beautiful. You know, when Aaron first died, when I wrote my book 5 years after he died, I talked about, you know, the recovery or the process of losing a child. And I alluded to the spiritual relationship one develops afterwards. If I were to write that book again, I would spend much more time on the spiritual relationship a parent has with their child after death, because I have found that to have grown substantially through the years. And I'll tell you, and this has a lot to do with mothers in particular, and yesterday, of course, was Mother's Day, and I have two beautiful other children, and I heard from them, and it was wonderful, but I still miss my son. And when I got the news that Aaron was murdered, we were waiting for 5 days, and the police, they finally found them in the woods. And I remember screaming in pain, and it felt like the umbilical cord was severed. Just like when a mother gives birth, you have that incredible pain, but it's replaced by joy. Well, this was the death labor. I realized afterwards that the umbilical cord would have to stretch far and wide to find my son, that could never be severed. And that's the spiritual cord that connects a mother and child. And that is what has occurred to me more and more through the years. And that cord is still very strong. It's as strong as it was in life. It's just a different kind of cord. It's like the Buddhist sense of the eternal soul, or, you know, those 49 ways now include the spiritual cord.
You know, Kathleen, I said in the introduction of the show that many people are going to choose not to listen to the show because it's too painful, too difficult to fathom. But part of your job here is to help us fathom what's unfathomable. So tell us about those first days and weeks and months, because I'm contrasting that with, I mean, I knew you right after his mm-hmm. death, and I'm looking at the woman now across the table from me who's traveling the world. You look full of energy and life, and you're radiant, and I remember that woman in those early days and weeks and months. So tell me about her.
Well, I think in the beginning, I call it the shattering. Now, particularly in a traumatic death where it's sudden, suicide, homicide, drug, or the shock of it is most apparent. But that is not to say that any other death of a child is not traumatic. Maybe you have a little more time, but you're also been through the war of suffering with that child. But nonetheless, whichever the case may be, you are shattered. There's something that is so catastrophic in this loss that words can never explain it. And when I work with mothers and parents today, I see that look and I recognize it. It's like there's a veil over the face, and it's shock. And somewhere behind that veil is that person. But they have been hit by such a storm that they're lost. And so you see people in various stages of that. And so the best thing a person can do to help that person is to take care of the immediate needs.
The physical needs, the
household needs, whatever happens. That person, it will take a while for them to realize what's actually happened. That you will see them come out of the shock in about 3 to 6 months. And then the reality hits. Curiously, at that time, 6 months later, people are backing off. They're not bringing food. They're not calling. They're not doing as much because they think, well, you know, you must be more okay. Because sometimes in the initial period of shock, you can actually function on adrenaline better. Or not better, but you know what I mean. It's afterwards when the shock starts wearing off and people realize this is not going away, I'm not waking up from this nightmare. Then they have to cope with what I call, in my book, the ocean of grief. They have to cross it. And the ocean is dark. It's turbulent. The undertow of grief drags them in. How are they going to survive? They've never done this before. And I base this on my own experience as well as a psychotherapist. I had no idea how I was going to navigate this ocean.
You use water metaphors a mm-hmm. great deal. So you just talked about the ocean of grief, which is a very powerful image, where it's a place where a lot of people get drowned mm-hmm. in the ocean. But when Aaron was killed, you had two other mm-hmm. children. And when we spoke with you earlier, your language was, let me find it here, after your son was murdered, your river of mothering went into the other children. Mm-hmm. So right. what's right. that?
Well, I think what happens is that need to mother, that natural need of mothering, goes into what remains. Now, at the same time, there's a river of grief that goes into the ocean of loss. So some of the emotion can be transferred into one's other children, which of course begs the bigger question, what happens? And I've worked with mothers who have lost their only child and how devastating that truly is. I can't imagine that because that is not my experience. But yes, some of the emotion, I found myself focusing on my two children. It's as if they moved up because Aaron was the oldest. You see, my daughter then became the oldest. But that did not take away the suffering for Aaron. You know, he had his own separate river.
I just wonder, this is so complicated when I try to put myself in the parent role, that so much energy is devoted to Aaron and your loss. And at the same time, you have to be a parent. But I wonder if your heart is there. And I wonder if you can be open and compassionate with the remaining children when so much of your energy is elsewhere.
Well, I think that's a very good question. And that's a hard one to answer. Because if I look back at it realistically, in the beginning, and I'm talking about the first month or 2 months, I was aware of my children. It was like we were all in the ocean. I could see them. I wanted to reach out to them. But there was... all of us were trying not to drown.
Right.
So you
right.
can't really hold on to each other. So you may be more intellectually aware of you need to take care of your other children, but the shock and all of the energy goes into the trauma right. of it's almost like a vortex. All that water goes into where the child is now, which is why I have mothers say to me, and I recall this in my own case, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. I
sure.
want to find my child. I am willing to go wherever he or she
right,
is.
Right.
The thing is, that doesn't mean that we're suicidal.
Right.
It
right.
means we want to go where we want to follow right. that river.
Right.
But the thing is, it takes us right into the ocean, and we have to cross the ocean,
right.
and it's so frightening.
Yeah.
It's so frightening because you've never done this before.
I want to talk to you about water after our break, because there's a lot of water here that we're talking about. So, among other things, we're...
Yes, yes. It's a great metaphor for emotion.
Water. Yeah, it sure
and
is.
And eternity.
And, you know, Jung said that that's, you know, universal experience of our soul, you know, what oceans. Well, we're going to take a short break. We're... talking with Kathleen O'Hara. She's a psychotherapist who specializes in traumatic grief, and her son Aaron was murdered 13 years ago, and I have forgotten the name of her book, which you will help me with right now.
A Grief Like No Other.
Thank you so much. It's a wonderful book and an important one. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from Jennifer Scalise. She's the author of Mother's Journey of Love, Loss, and Life Beyond. An ATV accident claimed the life of her daughter, Brooke. And, of course, we will take your calls. That's and we'll get to your calls right after right after our break. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
The Stockton Center on Successful Aging at the Stockton College of New Jersey supports WHYY and celebrates Older Americans Month on May 15th with its Festival on Successful Aging, featuring WHYY's Dr. Dan Gottlieb, Mike McGrath, and Wider Horizons' Willow Carey. With over 25 workshops, tours, performances, exhibitors, and an organic plant sale, the event runs from 9 to 4 and is open to the public. More information at stockton.edu or 609-652-4311.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb talking with psychotherapist Kathleen O'Hara, who specializes in traumatic grief counseling, primarily after the loss of a child. We had a caller in the first segment of our show, Kathleen, who wanted you to address the issue of suicide mm-hmm. and the emotions that come up mm-hmm. around there. She had a child who committed suicide, and there was a spate of them in the community. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's complicated. There's grief and a sense of responsibility for what you might have overlooked.
Well, I find that to be, I think, aside from the absolute longing and missing that we experience as parents and mothers, but it is what I have found in working with suicide survivors is the guilt. And that seems to be the strongest emotion within the first year. It is absolutely crucial to work through that. And I often think of it, or I've come to know it as almost, it's the block to acceptance. It's the thing that comes before acceptance, because in a way, if I keep going over in my mind what I could have done to save my child, as any parent would, then I still think my mind is playing tricks on me, because I think I can control the outcome. And so that going over and over and over means I can change it. I can change it if I think about it enough. Of course, you don't know you're doing that, but you do it naturally.
I'm afraid there are suicidologists and mental health professionals, and maybe myself included, that in some respects makes it worse when we talk about well over 90% of suicides are not done because Mary and Johnny broke up, but are done because there was a depression there. No, there was an illness in the brain that was either undertreated or untreated, and that adds to guilt, parental guilt.
Right, and I think that is the hardest emotion by far to deal with. It's agonizing. I call it the torture chamber. You just get on the rack, and you do it over and over and over again until you don't do it anymore, and that takes a long time. So you have to be patient with yourself and realize why you're doing it. Part of it is you're trying to change the outcome.
Yeah, that is our effort, isn't it? With regret, it's I call regret the persistence of the impossible.
Yeah,
you know, we keep trying to change history. Let's let's go to the phones. By the way, our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We are talking about parenting after the loss of a child. Give us a call if you've had that experience, your own, a neighbor, family, or a loved one. Like I said, let's go to the phones. We've got Valerie on the line.
Hi. I have a dear friend who just a few weeks ago, her 23-year-old daughter died after a four-month cancer illness, and it feels like the community that I'm in doesn't really know what to do to help. And I have had the experience of losing a baby, but not of a 23-year-old child, and I don't want to compare them, but I do think that I have had the experience of having to sit in it and make decisions about what I was going to do to go on. So I wondered if you guys had any thoughts about this for me.
Well, first of all, I think you do have that experience, because losing a child, regardless of the age, is a loss of hope. It's a loss of hope and loss of the future. You know, so I think that you can open up to your friend, and when she's ready to talk, maybe she can share her experience. You know, there's not a lot people can do. I mean, that's the truth of it. And I remember in my case, I appreciated the support, but I was in so much pain, I don't think that the desire people had to fix it was realistic.
The only way to fix pain is by not trying to fix it.
Well, but I think people want to help and they want to find an answer, because it's so difficult for them to imagine the pain. They want it, not maybe overtly fix it, but somehow make it better, which is a wonderful human emotion. But I think being able to sit with someone in their pain, take yourself out of it and just sit with them, ask them what they need, just be there, and maybe send a card, maybe call, bring food, you know, the things that we do in our community, and realize also that this is going to take a long time. And time is the thing that in our culture we don't seem to allow for.
Valerie, what did you need when you lost your child?
At first I needed to be alone.
Okay.
And just with, I think I was just with my mother and my husband, and then I needed to feel like people weren't afraid of me.
And how did you need them to be with you?
I'm mostly just coming and over, and just in the first 3 months, 3 or 4 months, it was the worst. I felt like I couldn't go out. I'd just been pregnant, so people knew it, and I didn't want to go out because I didn't want to talk about it. And people would come over and just talk about it with me.
So you needed people to talk about it with you, maybe even mention your child by name. You needed people who weren't afraid to be with your suffering. And
right.
And you needed simple companionship.
Right.
I would suggest that's exactly what your friend needs.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, Valerie. Let's bring on another guest. We'll bring on Jennifer Scalise. She's the author of A Mother's Journey of Love, Loss, and Life Beyond. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Like I mentioned earlier, you lost your 12-year-old daughter, Brooke, when you were on a vacation as a family, and her ATV careened down a mountainside. Did you experience what Kathleen referred to as that ocean of grief?
Absolutely. It was, you know, first we had the shock and the trauma of figuring out how to get home and how to get out of, you know, another country, and how to get Brooke back from there. So there was a whole other element, you know, similar to what Kathleen had, you know, a whole other element that she was dealing with being involved in murder. But once we reached that point, I absolutely, for 3 months straight, just went into a deep, dark place and barely got myself out of bed on a daily basis. And I would say that, you know, each person is going to have to do it their way and on what works on their terms. And for me, I had to go through that period of time. I would get myself up and be there for my children when they were here, not at school. But when they weren't with me, I was very ill.
Tell me about the children, Jennifer. Your other daughter was with you when all of this happened. How old was she?
Both Blake and Paige were with us. Paige was 6, and Blake was 14 at the time.
What happened to them in the immediate aftermath?
Paige was just scared. She was very scared, and I think she struggled to comprehend it. And Blake was in a little bit of denial. He was very optimistic, saying, no, I think, Mom, she's going to be okay. She just, she just maybe broke her legs. Or, we couldn't see over the cliff. You could just see the ocean below. And I felt it immediately. I said, no, she's gone. She's gone. I felt it inside me. And Blake immediately took on a very strong leadership role in our family. He became my strength, my ex-husband's strength, and he stepped up in every way possible. And then he later had to deal with his grief, a year later. But he was amazing through the time, and my significant other that was with me, he was there too, and he was, tremendous strength through it all. And, you do go through that period of just shock that you're able to function to some degree, but then you crash. You definitely crash.
I wonder if you were able to relate to some of the language, the metaphors Kathleen used, not just the ocean of grief, but I was struck by that vision of the umbilical cord, the first painful expulsion of that child, almost like giving birth, giving death to the child, but then the spiritual umbilical cord. That might not be your language, but did you have that kind of experience?
Oh, absolutely. You mean from the very beginning, the very second of the accident, I will relate to it because I could feel inside me. I could feel that she was gone even before I knew. I could feel that there was a change, and, I think of it as, that something happening there and a mother's intuition. And my situation was somewhat unique because of the fact that coming home, there were just a world of discoveries about my daughter that I hadn't known. And so the spiritual and the things that went on are just it's such an amazing story, because here, Brooke, obviously her soul was very aware of what was going to happen in her life. And she had written a letter less than 2 weeks before she passed that I found in her room that was written to God, and it said, I'm sorry I've sinned. I'm sorry I don't go to church more. Please help my mom understand we were made for you. She had just tons of letters that had to do with death and things that she was going to do. It went as far as to even diagram her major cause of her death, and just some very surreal things that took me some time to digest.
I was going to say, I can't even imagine. Kathleen, you had a reaction when you heard that. What was your reaction?
That this child had a profound soul and maybe was here to teach us something. Because I do believe that while death is on the physical level is so destructive, that beyond that, the experience of losing a child can be so transformative. And I think about that. I think about the role that Aaron played in so many other people's lives now. And it sounds like Brooke knew this was going to happen. And
Absolutely.
Wrote things that maybe can help someone else, parents, understand. Here's the thing. We think our children belong to us. particularly we mothers, because we have knit those bones in our womb. So we in a strange way possess that child until something happens. And then we realize that some children belong to the world.
Well, as much as I respect you, Kathleen, Khalil Gibran said it even better than you.
In
his poem For the Children, when he said, "Your children are not your children. They are life's longing for itself."
Yes.
You know, they come through you, but not from you. And it's a literal truth.
Tell that to any mother tiger. He was a guy. Us mothers, this is why I think, and maybe Jennifer, you would agree with this, that, you know, mothers are sweet and loving and kind, but boy, mess with our kids.
Yeah.
And it's something else. And that's why I think it's so devastating for us, because we knit those bones. We created that child in our womb. Regardless of the role God and the soul had, we made that body. And that is why for a mother to go to the grave of her child is so unfathomable.
I just want to say something as someone who's not a mother. When you say we knit those bones, there was a little sperm.
Okay, I was going to mention it. I was going to say, okay.
Yeah,
but you know, you guys have the fun and dry, you know.
But then we
do all the work, okay?
All right. No. Enough.
And I love the fathers. Please don't, you know. I'm kidding.
All right. Let's go to the phone.
Right, Jennifer?
There is a difference, I feel. But I do have to say that, you know, parents. I have to give, you know, my children have all been very close with their father, so I certainly don't want to dismiss that.
Thank you. because I'm the one to put the finger on the button here.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, exactly.
All right,
wow.
All right, wait a minute. That's enough.
Let's go to the call.
It's enough fun.
But I have realized that Brooke was, I was blessed to have her for 12 years, but I do realize now she does belong to the world. And I'm happy to share her because I see the lives that she's changing.
That's the issue. It's always about sharing, no matter what the subject matter is. It's always about sharing. Let's go to the phones. We've got several people who want to comment on this discussion. Let's start with Glenn. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Good. I wanted to call in and give a father's perspective. 20 months ago, we lost our son, Sullivan, who was 20. And it's still hard. But fathers do feel the same. Well, I wouldn't say the same, but I want to speak for fathers that they still have that trauma that continues and that they have to work through. I think the second year can be harder.
Say more. Do you mind saying more, Glenn, about what you went through the first year, what you're going through now?
Sure. The first year, I believe the adrenaline, the support, the network really helped us continue. The second year, I mean, we certainly are continuing and life does go on, but daily, sometimes almost every hour, you are thinking about your son and what you've been through and how you'll continue. We definitely know that we'll continue. It's just the trauma can be traumatic. I think people need to know that you want to hear from them continually. You know, you can keep bringing up their name, stories about them. It's very helpful. I'm not sure how long this process takes, but certainly longer than 2 years.
Glenn, I want to say something, and I hear it in your voice. I hear it in your voice, and I hear the depth of your sadness. And I agree. I think the second year, honestly, is harder than the first, because you're right. The first, we're all caught up in it. It's the second year that we realize this is not going away, and he's not coming back. And I think the thing I missed so much was people not saying my son's name. It was as if, okay, now we're supposed to get over it, and, you know, and it still hurts today. that people don't say his name. But I thank you so much for sharing that, Glenn, and I know.
I do agree that I think that is the hardest thing as a parent, and I think it's the same for, you know, grandparents too, is to be around people that kind of avoid the subject. And that is what our society struggles to talk about death or to accept this. And as we go through it, we realize how common death of a child really is, and how as a society we've got to learn how to accept and deal with death more than we do. In general, it's just something that we kind of clam up and avoid talking about. And as time goes by, we're all going to have more and more death in our life. And some of my best friends still to this day don't know how to be around me. And it's interesting because they'll be afraid that they're going to cry. And my son said it best. He said, "Mom, I like it when people cry. It shows that they care. It shows that they have feelings about it." And if people would just ask us, you know, what, how do you feel? You know, what is the best thing for me to do around you? Do you prefer to talk about Brooke? Is it better to not talk about her? People just don't have that comfort level to even bring that question up. They just almost want to avoid the subject.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not your job, and you don't even have the emotional resources to help make them comfortable. Jennifer, I'd like you to do something for all of us. The epilogue of your book, especially those first two paragraphs, were very poignant and very sweet, and I'd like you to take us up to the break by reading those two paragraphs.
Sure, great. It is difficult to believe over 2 years have flashed by since that tragic afternoon on July 13th, 2009. Oddly, it feels like yesterday that Brooke and I laughed as we shared those special last moments together, while at the same time, the traumatic experience of the accident itself is so surreal that it feels like a distant dream from long ago. I feared that as time progressed, my memories of Brooke would fade. Thankfully, that is not so. In fact, I can imagine her in my mind as vividly now as when she stood physically before me 2 years ago. I treasure the wonderful memories of all the special things we did together, and I reflect on them often. Each day, I stop and take time to connect with Brooke. This may be looking at photos, watching home videos, reading her journal, or simply closing my eyes and reliving a moment in time when we were together. Feeling close to her brings a smile to my face and a sense of peace in knowing she will forever live on in my heart.
Just beautiful. And I thank you so much for reading that and writing that. That was Jennifer Scalise. She's the author of A Mother's Journey of Love, Loss, and Life Beyond. Her daughter died in an ATV accident about 12 years ago, 10 or 11 years ago. Jennifer, thank you so much for your book. Thank you so much for what you are doing for your suffering. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Just to clarify, Brooke passed away in 2009.
Oh, I'm sorry. My mistake.
No, that's okay.
We're also joined here in the studio by Kathleen O'Hara. She specializes in traumatic grief counseling, and she also survives the homicide of her son, and her book is called?
A Grief Like No Other.
Yeah, you know my memory. A Grief Like No Other. We've got lots of people on the line. When we come back, we will take your calls. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
ChristianaCare Health System Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year. And the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about parenting after the loss of a child with psychotherapist Kathleen O'Hara. And as promised, I want to get to the phones right away. Let's start with Gail. Gail, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my name's Gail. My son took his life about 3 weeks ago. He hooked up the exhaust in his car, and unfortunately it also caught fire. He had paranoid schizophrenia, suffered for about 12 years. He was 12 or so hospitalizations in jail, and we never gave up on him. And very fortunately, his last hospitalization, he received an injection of an Invega drug that we felt turned him around. He had insight into his illness. He was discharged. But they made a decision, I won't name the hospital, in Maine, to not give the follow-up injection because of the cost. We had begged to be a part of the treatment team. I am an RN. We always stood by him, and he came home and dove into a great depression. My question is, my husband and I now are going to pursue answers. And it seems like it won't bring him back, but we want answers from professionals, from the hospital itself, and from the legal system. And should we go ahead with this?
When we experience an injustice, every part of our being wants to find justice. A part of you was taken, and by the way, all death to a certain extent feels like a murder, and we want to find the murderer to find justice, and that's some of what I'm hearing from you. And you know, I'm not in a position to recommend whether you do it or not, but the only thing I care about with you, Gail, and with your husband, and I'm sure Kathleen feels the same way, the only thing I care about is you and your welfare and your journey, or your healing journey here. That's the only thing that matters here. So you have to decide based on that one criteria. Will this help you? Will it help your husband? And if the answer is yes, then that's your answer. So that's my recommendation. Are you there?
I am. Thank you very much.
Gail, I am so sorry for your loss. You have been struggling with variations on loss for many years. I am so sorry for your
Thank you.
For your suffering.
Thank you.
Please take care.
Thanks.
Yes, Gail. It's very hard. I know that. I just want to add one comment. In the criminal justice system, when there's a homicide, you actually have no choice. They go, if they do find the murderer, you go through the criminal justice system. And I can tell you that it is extremely painful to do that. And so Dan is right. In the case where there's a choice, you might want to think about what it's going to cost you emotionally. And you may decide to still do it.
Yeah, cost and benefit. You're right. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Mike on the line. Hi, Mike. Mike?
Hi, Dr. Dan. Two things. I want to thank you, first of all, for taking my call, and second of all, I want to thank you for another phenomenal show. I went through a loss probably nowhere near what your guests have. I lost my first daughter at birth, haunted me for 25 years until I had another girl. Thing to go through. Don't think you ever get over it. You just learn to manage it better. But one point I did want to bring up, and certainly no offense to your guest. We're getting a lot of mother's perspective. Fortunately, we just had a caller give a father's perspective. One thing to take into consideration, when a couple goes through the loss of a child, through any means, whether it's murder or suicide or a natural cause, a medical condition, whatever, it's extremely difficult on both. I can't say one outweighs the other, but herein lies the difference as I see it. A woman can openly grieve. She can cry. She can go through all the outward emotions. She can get all the support from friends and from different groups she can join. A man takes it a little bit differently. We take it internally. We're not programmed or conditioned to be able to outwardly expel some of that grief. And it becomes an extremely burning sensation and a very difficult sensation to internalize it and almost have to deal with it yourself. And if I could possibly say it makes it more difficult for the man, for the father, I really believe that it does for that reason. I certainly do not diminish or dismiss the suffering that the mother goes through. Absolutely, it's there.
Mike, I think your
guests seem to think that there's this knitting of the bones, this maternal issue that makes them feel the loss more. I think that's a bit of an unfair opinion.
Mike, let me stop you there. I did not mean that. What I simply meant was that men and women grieve differently. I certainly was not disparaging the grief of men at all. In fact, one of the things I notice in my practice, and I wish this wasn't true, is that just like you're saying, men don't come in. They don't come in to get the help. They keep that inside, and it does burn a big hole in them. And I wish that wasn't the case, because the help is there.
And we do know, both Mike and Kathleen, that vulnerability invites compassion, but an image of strength does not. But, you know, it's not, Mike, you seem to be implying, and I agree with you, it's not a simple choice with men. Well, I'm going to keep this closed, or I'm going to open up. It's not a simple choice. In many respects, it's part of our wiring. We have never learned those mechanisms. Yes, Mike?
Right.
Yeah.
It's true. And to Dan, thank you, and to your guests as well. I appreciate the time on the thank you for taking my call.
Take care of yourself, Mike. Yeah, I mean, it does make a point. It is very, very different.
I think that one of the things I notice when I have couples in my practice that are both grieving, that I think the differences between men and women need to be recognized. And there isn't, it's not certainly a competition, but I think that the grief really puts a stress on the marriage in particular because of the different ways people grieve.
And they expect one another to feel the same way.
And sometimes when the man does come in, I talk about that, and allowing and respecting each other's individual right to grieve the way they do.
Yeah.
And that can help.
Yeah, it's such an important issue. You know, Mike said we don't get over it. You said about trauma, you said we don't get better, we get different.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
I think Mike made a comment, going back to his, we manage it. No matter how much time goes by, we learn to manage it. We live with it, and we allow it to transform us. If we're lucky and if we work at it, then it becomes a transformatory value. We are different people. We can never go back to being the same. And that's good for our families and friends to know, because they want the old us back. They're not going to get it. We're new people. We're different people. And maybe when we come out of the ocean of grief, we will be different, hopefully in a good way, but we'll always have that pain. It's a shadow. In fact, a very old and dear friend of mine whose daughter was murdered maybe 30 years ago said, you know, it's like clouds on the horizon. Most of the time, they're distant and gray, but at times, they get stronger and the storm comes. And this was 30 years later.
Mm.
So I think that, to me, is a really good metaphor.
Mm.
The clouds are there. But they're manageable.
Yeah, they always are. In all our lives, they're always there. We've only got a minute left, and I just want to tick off a couple of issues for people we're unfortunately not going to be able to get on this show. But one woman called in to say she lost twins, and she said she was being taught a lesson, which is hurtful. It's really hurtful, as though somebody knows answers that she doesn't. Now, another one called in to say that she lost a one-year-old son, and she found it helpful to write journals. And, and coming back to Mike and men, you know, if you're not comfortable opening up, maybe you'd be more comfortable opening up to yourself. And I know journal writing is really helpful, and you're a big advocate of for creativity as part of the healing process. It's really important. So you're off traveling around the world helping people.
I'm speaking next week at a conference in the Netherlands for Victim Support Europe and how to help people just like myself and others who have experienced the homicide of a family member.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. And
you're very welcome. It's been my pleasure, and I hope it's helped people out there, and we're all together in this family. We really are.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people out there. I've got two pieces of good news. One is that I remembered the name of your book. It's called A Grief Like No Other. And the other piece of good news from my audience is Kathleen O'Hara is right here in Philadelphia, and please call her if you feel you want or need help. She's a psychotherapist who specializes in traumatic grief counseling and victim rights advocacy. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking with Brian Sykes, among others. He's the author of a new book, DNA USA, A Genetic Portrait of America. We're going to talk about finding our roots. Well, you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Our production team is at voices@whyy.org. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Jerome Goldman is our new summer intern. Welcome, Jerome. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn's our producer, and I'm Dan.